Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times, and Art Doroche of The Athletic. A hugely significant night for football, featuring far-reaching protest in Paris. But business as usual for Manchester United. Flawed selection, tactical incoherence, weak goalkeeping, chaotic defending, and attacks thrown together in desperation when it was all too late. United are out of the Champions League and out of excuses. Surely, Johnny, something's got to give, hasn't it?
It does, Mike, but it feels like something's had to give at Manchester United for several years now. The attention will be on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, of course. And I've been a defender of Ole, but he has to be under scrutiny now. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. To go out of that Champions League group, having, you know, beaten Paris Saint-Germain and then won 5-0 against Leipzig after those two games. It's like that England test match in Australia where they scored 550 in the first innings and managed to get beaten. It's extraordinary to lose from that position. And then you look at the league form, and although, you know, the table says that they're doing okay, in reality, the performances have been really patchy. I saw United play brilliantly against Everton, but I've also seen them be dismal against Crystal Palace. The last two victories were the result of you know, salvage jobs after the disastrous first half. So my stance with Ole has always been that I think there's been a lot of glib criticism of him, a lot of over-the-top criticism, with people willfully ignoring the achievements he's had. But he's got to keep United progressing. Until this season, he was progressing them. It's been a regression this last few weeks since the season started. And I guess the question now will be, can he arrest this decline? Can he restore some sort of direction? But to go back to your remark, Mike, about something having to give, I do think that if they make a decision to relieve Solskjaer of his duties, it won't solve even half the problems at that football club. And that's what's really got to give, you know, a solution to the systemic problems Manchester United have had, really, for the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, I suppose when you can look at it, you know, it's easy to condemn Solskjaer. And I don't actually agree with Phil Neville when he says that, you know, the manager's victim of a witch hunt. However, Art, is this all a sign of a team and a club which have got fundamental issues which are basically being ignored because of almost corporate expedience?
I think in a sense, yes, but you've also got to look at the footballing aspects of everything that's happening at the club right now. And I think what everyone can see right now watching Manchester United over the past 3 months or so is that they just, when people say they've been inconsistent, I want to use that lightly, because there has been a consistency in them having to claw back from losing positions. We've seen that throughout the season, and I think that's not the consistency any manager would want. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been trying to find the solution. But in that, I think you do have to stick to one kind of way and try and make that work, rather than constantly switching, which will only cause more confusion, I feel. And that also stems from the problems that come above him, because when you're appointing David Moyes, letting him go after not even a year, then you try Louis van Gaal, he wins an FA Cup, but he's out the door, and you get in Jose Mourinho, he wins the Europa League, the Carabao Cup as well, and then things get a bit rocky with him. You relieve him of his duties and then you bring in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I don't think just letting managers walk out the door as soon as they hit a rocky patch is going to solve the issues. And it's a problem that isn't just lying at the footstep of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but the players and the management above him too.
Let's look at those in authority, Johnny, if we could. I look around and I wonder who actually has the football credibility to make far-reaching decisions on the management. Now, you've worked with Sir Alex. What do you think he'll be making of this? Because I know he's taken a discernible step backwards out of the limelight, but is there any influence there still?
I'm afraid not. I think he'll be hugely frustrated and probably feels quite impotent because he has been, you know, it might be kind to say that they've made him take a step back. I think he's been edged out of the picture in reality by Ed Woodward and the Glazers, and he's left with this sort of ceremonial role. And, you know, Solskjaer is a protege of his, of course. Maybe they're not quite as close as you know it's portrayed sometimes, but he'll be really disappointed. What will upset him, I think, is the unpicking of the identity that he created, the lack of identity you see with Manchester United now at all levels. Solskjaer had, you know, he had a plan up to a point. I think we could see where it was going. And if you try and think about an alternative ownership of Manchester United, you know, Solskjaer gets to this summer. He's got them back in the Champions League. He's found a bit of a formula with Greenwood and Rashford, with Fernandes. You know, it's starting to look like Manchester United. And he wanted Jude Bellingham. He wanted Sancho. You know, the year before he wanted Haaland. Now, Manchester United might be a very different team if you've been able to get those players. And I'm not saying that justifies the shambles of last night or justifies, you know, means that Solskjaer's off the hook. But it's a chaotically run club where those transfers were doable for Manchester United. But because of the corporate structure, the weird habit they've got of penny pinching up to a point and then on the last day of a transfer window then just blowing everything. And it'll, you know, Art will probably recognise that from Arsene Wenger's final days. It was a bit like that with Arsenal. But it's that weird handling of business, that lack of planning, and it has undermined Solskjaer. You know, the Pogba situation undermines Solskjaer. The Van de Beek situation undermines Solskjaer. The fact he's got so many poor defenders, they can't get off the books, stops them bringing in better defenders to improve the team. So, you know, and then you've got this kind of culture at the club that's gone rotten because of a club that's been focused on making money and getting clicks rather than winning football matches. And that does infect things. So there's all that in the picture. You've got a manager that's stopped, I think, progressing the football club and yes, should be looked at. You've got players that could be changed. But you've got this bigger picture, and it might be boring for fans to hear because they want a quick answer. They want sack the guy, bring in Pochettino, everything will be fine. I don't think it would be fine if they did that. I'd fear for Pochettino because Jose Mourinho's not a bad manager, is he? And it swallowed him up. It keeps swallowing people up, and that's Manchester United's problem.
Yeah, lest we forget, the Glazers and their associates are going to be picking up an £11 million dividend in a couple of weeks. I want to go on to Pogba and also his agent, Raiola. Art, you know, we're no strangers to the manipulative ways of super agents, but I thought there was a complete lack of respect to the football club, which I thought was revealing, in essentially touting Pogba around yet again. From Solskjaer's point of view, though, when he actually brought him on against Leipzig, he did improve them, didn't he?
Yeah, I think when you watch the game, it was a left-footed pass from, I think he was just outside his own box, over the top to Greenwood, which won them the penalty. And then when you see that, I don't want to compare it to his pass in the World Cup final, but it is very kind of like he can change a game very quickly by himself. He has the qualities to do that. And I think seeing him every day, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to know that and want to bring the best out of him. And he's not going to want to try and force him out straight away, even with what Raiola has said, which is it's put him in a very difficult spot a few weeks before the January transfer window. But then even you see later on in the game where he's basically the one that got them the goal, even though there was a little bit of involvement from Harry Maguire. But it's him at the back post again making the difference. And I think no one can question his ability. It's just having to do that on a consistent basis, which he hasn't done since his return to Manchester United. And I think where his agent is making those remarks in public as well, I think that's the main thing, is that it's in public. If it's behind closed doors, then it may be easier for Solskjaer to manage in the fact that he knows where he stands and he'll know where Pogba and his agent stand. But now that it's everyone's got an opinion on it, it just makes it that much more difficult to manage. And I feel from Pogba's point of view, he just has to play football. And if it is for a move away from Manchester United, him playing well will help his case. If it's to stay at Manchester United, him playing well would help his case as well. So either way you look at it, I think last night was a win for Paul Pogba, even though Manchester United lost.
Yeah, there are some far-reaching decisions to be made for the City game at the weekend, aren't there, Johnny? Obviously, Pogba will feature in the speculation and the build-up to that. What about the goalkeeping situation? David De Gea struck me as being fundamentally weak last night. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think De Gea has been clearly way past his best form for a season and a half. There's probably a deeper problem with De Gea, that even when he was playing really well, was he the right goalkeeper for Manchester United? Because he's a goalkeeper that wants to stay on his line the entire game. He doesn't push a team up. So, you know, been in situations where they've lacked that sort of sweeper keeper, where they've been trying to attack, trying to have a high line, but they've got a goalkeeper that stands back all the time. So even a top De Gea may not be the right goalkeeper for Manchester United. But it was weak, semi-committed last night. Dean Henderson is in the wings and probably deserves his chance. I don't want to continue to be totally doom and gloom about United. I actually have questions as to whether Henderson's a top-class goalkeeper as well, but he does deserve an opportunity to show us. He's certainly got the confidence to be a Manchester United goalkeeper. And yes, I would put him in against Manchester City, because you have to treat goalkeeping, you know, you have to be fair and play the guy on form, and that is not David De Gea at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I suppose clubs have to start forming an orderly queue outside the door marked crisis clubs, don't they, at the moment? Your club, Arsenal, are they still suffering, a little bit like Manchester United, from the Wenger era? You know, we all see the way the United took time and several managers to move on from Fergie. Do the same systemic issues remain at the club?
I think it's not as high profile as Manchester United, but there are instances of that. When you see the squad that Mikel Arteta inherited, it's, okay, well, actually not just the squad that he's inherited, but the squad he has now. It's players from the Arsene Wenger era, players from the Unai Emery era, and now players he's brought in himself, such as Cedric, Pablo Mari, Thomas Partey, Willian. And that mix, you're not going to have players that are all in his vision, I don't feel, even if he is able to convince them to all sing of his hymn sheet. I don't feel that they're all going to be stylistically his type of player. And we've seen that in how he had to switch to a back three at the back end of last season to find that solidarity at the back, but sacrifice the creativity going forward. And now, after the most recent international break with Arsenal, moving back to the back four, they don't have any of that creativity anymore when they try to go forward, and it's a real issue. So I think the problem isn't just, oh, is it a Wenger kind of hangover, I guess I'll call it, but it is Mikel Arteta finding his own way and the way that actually works, because he did find a way in a sense with the back three towards the back end of last season, but that isn't the way that he initially wanted to play football at Arsenal, and it's not the way that fans have wanted him to play football at Arsenal in recent weeks either.
You talk about fans, there is pressure from, I think, what is a pretty notably hysterical fan base. I'm talking about Arsenal Fan TV, for instance, which frankly is just a circus. When you look at that and you listen to it, is that part of the problem?
In a sense, it can be sometimes, depending on who is actually viewing that. If it's players, then confidence can get affected, which is a real problem. But in terms of a management sense, I don't think it would be too much of a problem for Mikel Arteta, because the way that Arsenal have gone about his appointment and what's happened since then, it's been very Project Mikel in a way, in the sense that he was given a longer contract than Unai Emery got when he first got a job. Unai Emery was given 2 years with an option of a third. Mikel Arteta was given 3.5 years straight away. And I think since then, we've seen him promoted to from head coach to manager. We've seen a lot of structural change in the club, where Raul Senlehi, for instance, is now not at the club anymore, but Mikel Arteta is now heading up recruitment with the technical director, Edu. And I feel the direction the club is going in is very much geared to help Mikel Arteta succeed rather than do what Manchester United have been doing for the past 7 years in getting in high profile manager and letting him go when things get rocky. I think Arsenal were even reluctant to relieve Unai Emery of his duties, and I think they don't want to be viewed as a sacking club, and they're going to try their best to make this work if they can.
Let's look at the strategic decisions being made, Johnny, specifically Aubameyang. Big contract. Didn't they learn anything from the Ozil situation? And with hindsight, do you think they should have cut what would have been substantial losses and got rid of him in the summer?
No, not at all. I don't have any real worries about Aubameyang. I think he's a different character, first of all, to Ozil. I think he's very much shown he's a team player, and in any way Ozil might not be. And you can see him suffering on the pitch. He's not going through these games in this bad scoreless run he's in lightly. You know, he clearly has got the desire to do well. I just think he's a top player, and he's having a bad run, and he will come good. The team's got to help him, from my point of view. I think if there's a problem that's affecting him is how slow Arsenal's football's become, the lack of creativity and their inability to move the ball quickly into the forward areas, which is, you know, when as Art mentioned, the back three, and it was one of the reasons it was working well creatively, was they developed this great way of getting, sucking teams forward, drawing them on, and then getting out really quickly and releasing Aubameyang quickly. He needs the game played at speed. He needs the ball in front of him. He needs to be coming onto it, and he needs speed in the passing to make that happen. And Arsenal just got so bogged down that by the time he gets the ball, he's often just sort of standing, waiting for it in the box, and that's not his game. I think Lacazette moving into number 10 might eventually help him, because he's shown good signs there that he might be able to find those passes. But then, you know, Arsenal are a bit lopsided at the moment because Pepe hasn't been the player that they hoped he'd be. They need a solution on the other side. So I just put Aubameyang's problems down to Arsenal's problems, and I would trust in his ability and his character in a way that you might not do, let's say, with Ozil.
Yeah, what about a broader look at them tactically? Are ineffective at set pieces, poor chance creation, over-reliance on someone like Thomas Partey?
I think the set pieces one is very interesting. I've written a couple pieces in recent months about their free kicks, their corners. I think there's been, in terms of corners anyway, there's been like a clear plan in terms of they have a few set routines, one which people are seeing most frequently is when they kind of try to box the keeper in and go to either the near post or the far post, but that hasn't been working on a consistent basis anyway, because more often than not, the delivery from these set pieces is just not good enough, whether it's Willian or Reece Nelson or Nicola Pepe. There's often times where they don't get the ball past the first man. And when you lose those margins, you're going to pay for it, because as Jamie Carragher pointed out on Monday Night Football, Chelsea are excelling in that area, and it's a key reason why they're so high up in the table. in a broader sense, tactically, I think what really helped Mikel Arteta as well when he switched to that back three was players like Bukayo Saka and Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who almost played as floaters on the pitch. They're not wing-backs at heart, but they've got the qualities that can help the side there, where they often push into more central areas, create overloads, and then are able to push the ball forward quickly. I don't think Arsenal have had that without them, and that's been an area where they've suffered a lot since moving to a back four, where Granit Xhaka is often the person who drops into into the back line and has to create as a quarterback from there, where he's not as effective as he was before this season. And I feel it's just getting that movement from the defensive third to the middle third to the final third, getting that to be a lot smoother is the issue. Johnny mentioned Lacazette as a 10, and I think that is something that could work. I also wrote about that last week after he played there against Mold and Rapid Vienna, and he linked play quite nicely with Rhys Nelson and Eddie Nketiah and Nicola Pepe in those games. But he's not the typical number 10 who has the physical attributes to properly thrive there. He has the technical attributes, but Arsenal are going to need someone with both to thrive well in that situation. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to anoint you as our goalkeeping expert, Johnny, but if the goalkeeping hat fits, wear it, or cap fits, wear it. In hindsight, did Arsenal sell the wrong goalkeeper?
Oh, I have thought that. No, I like Leno. In fact, I saw him years ago in the Bundesliga and was tweeting, oh my goodness, why hasn't anyone signed this guy? He'd be amazing in the Premier League. And I got all these German football fans coming back and listing mistakes he'd made against, Hoffenheim and Dortmund and all that kind of stuff, and saying, you actually need to watch this guy. He's got ricks in him. And he was... he wasn't great in the North London derby. He's a good presence though, and he's I was talking about De Gea's inability to command his box and push people out. I mean, Leno can do that, and he can distribute the ball. And if Arsenal want to, speed up the attacking game and probably play the football we imagine. I mean, we all kind of assume that Arteta wants to play Guardiola football. I mean, that is a big assumption. We haven't seen it yet, but we assume that he does. And you need a goalkeeper like Leno for that. So I think he's a bit of a poor man's version of an Edison or whatever. But, he's okay. I wouldn't start my issues with him. I would sort of maybe get round to looking at that situation after sorting quite a few other things out, so I could sort of give him a lukewarm 6 out of 10 or something.
your name shines in the Thursday night lights, doesn't it? So Europa League, you're following Arsenal in that. They got Dundalk away on Thursday. Is the Europa League a possible safety valve for Arteta and the season as a whole?
It was last season. It was for Unai Emery the season before, and it is now, for the simple reason that it can get him back into the Champions League. Even though he got knocked out at the first hurdle against Olympiacos last season, the main kind of focus for Arteta was to go and win the Europa League. And I think we've seen that again with how he's approached the group stage this year, with the strength of the teams that he's been picking. A lot of people would have expected him to rotate a lot more and blood in a lot more youngsters, such as Emile Smith Rowe, Miguel Aziz, Flo Balogun. But he's chosen to go with more experienced players such as Nicola Pepe, Alexandre Lacazette, and then also the more mature young players, I'd say, in Joe Willock, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, Eddie Nketiah, where they've already got a decent amount of first-team experience. I feel the way Arteta looks at it, it's a competition he'll be more than happy to win, because of the prize at the end of, because of the gold at the end of the tunnel. If he can do that in the smoothest way possible, I think he'd bite your hand off for that right now.
Yeah. What about Spurs, Johnny? They strike me as, I think the way they approached the Europa League, okay, they had a whinge about it, but they'd gone on with it. That told me that Mourinho had almost established his control there. You've got the Europa League on Thursday again. Is it another chance for people like Vinicius to start against Royal Antwerp and to basically give the lie to the fact that we wonder about Tottenham's depth?
Yeah, I think Tottenham has crept up on us, actually, but they've got a really decent squad now, which you got to take your hat off to Mourinho, the way he used the summer transfer so well to build strength and depth everywhere. But yeah, I think when you really look at it now, they have got good alternatives in most positions. It helps that you know, Harry Kane's now sort of changing his game a little bit, and it's allowing, you know, them to be maybe less reliant on him for goals. So we're not looking at them as that in that one-dimensional sense. But yeah, you've got people like Lucas Moura, you've got Lamella. Vinicius is as good a backup to Kane as they've ever had. You know, Lo Celso was playing at the weekend because Ndombele was injured, but Lo Celso is essentially a backup player. Another, you know, really decent option. Someone like Davinson Sanchez. They have now got not just good backups, but an ethos, as you mentioned, Mike, that Mourinho has chosen to take the Europa League reasonably seriously. And they've got an ethos now of every game counting. You know, that's part of the winning mentality, I think, Mourinho's been trying to instill in them. And of players clearly wanting to get on the pitch and show what they can do. And we haven't mentioned probably the best backup player in Europe in Gareth Bale. I mean, you know, it's a chance for him to come and show what he can do. They just look like they're enjoying everything at the moment, even the Europa League. And I'm into every Tottenham game is interesting. Now, every Arsenal game is interesting for slightly different reasons, but every Tottenham game is interesting precisely because of that strength and depth. You think you're going to see good performances and you're going to see a team really going at it, even on a Thursday night.
You've got, obviously, one of the trials of modern management is keeping players happy in overstocked squads. Now, that brings us on to Chelsea. You know, some talk about Callum Hudson-Odoi maybe leaving in January. Has there been renewed interest from Bayern, perhaps? Giroud would be a first choice at most other clubs. Do you expect in January to see a few departures?
Personally, no. I think we've seen with both of these players, they've had these episodes before, especially Hudson-Odoi with Bayern and Olivier Giroud last January with Tottenham and Inter Milan specifically. And I think Frank Lampard's going to know he's going to need these players as the season goes on if he wants to go into the latter stages of the Champions League, FA Cup, and also continue to challenge for a top four spot in the Premier League. With Giroud, I feel he's a striker. I loved when he was at Arsenal. I know that wasn't a popular opinion at the time, but his movement has always been a strength. That movement from in to out to the near post has always been there. I remember a goal he scored against Tottenham in the North London Derby in September 2013, where he's at the near post. It was either Walker or Rzyski that played the short ball across the near post, and he was there to tap it in. And that was a goal he scored, type of goal he scored very consistently for Arsenal, as well as having that strength in the air, which of course he showed in the last round of the Champions League to be especially good with his goal at the death to win away at Rennes. And I feel for Chelsea, he's going to be a striker where Tammy Abraham can learn off, Timo Werner can learn off, and having him there is going to be invaluable to Frank Lampard for as long as he can. With the Euros coming in this summer as well, that may lead people to believe that he needs a move, but when he's Chelsea's most complete striker, I don't think he necessarily needs to be moving anywhere, and he can prove himself under Frank Lampard, who has proven last year and has proven this year that he does trust him.
Yeah, I'd just like to, if I could, Johnny, also now broaden the discussion. I mentioned in the intro about unprecedented scenes in Paris last night. Collective action in players from both sides walking off because of allegations of racial abuse by a fourth official. That has obviously still to take its course. Nothing's proven as we speak. But if it is proven, what action will or should UEFA take, do you feel?
Well, this is a crossroads for UEFA, because they have to put their action where their mouth is, I suppose. They love their banners, they love their adverts, and we've always been a bit suspicious about their true intentions, their true motivations when it comes to combating discrimination, racism, because of the pathetic penalties they actually hand out to offenders, and because of the priorities they seem to have when they think that commercial things are more important. And I have to say, the way it was handled, the way the incident was handled last night, spoke to me of that UEFA contradiction. You know, their solution was to remove this fourth official and put him in the VAR truck, you know, as if the sanctity of VAR was more important than protecting the players and participants of the game from discrimination. And, you know, they should have just carried on, done without VAR, gone an official down and just carried on the game. But that seemed to be their twisted priorities. I think we have moved on in the understanding or discussion of racism around football, and we have moved past the idea that racial abuse can own, or racism is only a problem when it's abuse, when it's a word voiced with, you know, bad intent by somebody towards another person. Racism's a machinery as well, and the this incident was an official, we think, allegedly, you know, defining someone by their colour rather than as an individual, which is maybe we have to understand, you know, that we understand that now as discrimination and as part of racism, which is an advance. But UEFA have got to back that up now by taking action, and that doesn't necessarily mean hanging this Romanian guy out to dry. I don't understand what that, you know, that might not necessarily do any good either, but certainly making it clear what the issue is here. And I would suggest, you know, not I think this official is about to retire anyway, but I think he should maybe speed up that retirement, and being as strong and as clear on this as they suggest that they're always going to be when they make those adverts, but then never follow through with action. Because again, it was the players of the participants in the game had to lead the action. You know, thank goodness for Demba Ba, thank goodness for Kylian Mbappe, and the officials, the Basak, now I can't say the name, the Turkish side's staff who I admired. But you know what I mean? Again, we're in a situation where it's the players and the coaches having to lead action, and not the officials and not the authorities. And that's the change that we need to come out of this.
Yeah, what struck me last night, Art, was I watching football's Tommy Smith moment? You know, we all know about the power salutes on the Olympic podium. And as Johnny was talking about there, UEFA, in essence, abrogated their responsibility and let the players decide whether or not the game was going to go ahead. It's obviously going to be restarted on Wednesday evening. You know players, you especially younger players, are they at the point now where they want to reflect their disgust, and there is much more chance of the sort of collective action that we saw last night? Will players start walking off?
I think there is more chance of that, but I'm not sure if that would happen in England in terms of in a league match. I'm not sure if English players would be as confident to do it as, say, Demba Ba was in leading last night's protests, I guess we'll call it, as he has experienced it before and he's taken a stance before. To take his words as well, I think when the authorities are looking at it, when it's a black player that might take a stand, they won't take it as seriously as when a white player would do it. And I think somebody brought up the example of if Cesar Azpilicueta walked off, would it be more powerful? And Demba Ba said it would be, not because it's Cesar Azpilicueta, but because it's a white player taking a stand with someone of a different race. Whereas if it was to be black players taking that stance, well, we've seen they've been taking that stance for months now, and the results haven't really been changing that much. So where the sincerity might come is when it is a stance that's taken by more people in a more serious tone. In terms of just younger players, I think when they see players such as Demba Ba acting the way they did last night and speaking out for themselves, they will probably feel more empowered to do so themselves. But it also comes to a personal decision whether they would want to do that. I'm not going to sit here and say every single black player must walk off the pitch, because in the end, it's a personal decision. And we saw how QPR, for instance, I'm sure we're going to talk about them, we've seen how they've kind of adjusted their approach in light of what happened on the weekend. And it all comes in different forms, but I think the stances are more powerful when they come in unison with each other.
That's right, but about the walking off, but it shouldn't come to players having to walk off. And the fact that it does is the failure of the authorities. It's like being racially abused in your workplace and having to leave that workplace because your employer isn't handling it. And that's what walking off of a football pitch. The players don't want to walk off. They don't want it. They don't want to not play the game of football they've come to play. And that's a powerful thing to have to do. But the fact players are having to do it and having to contemplate it shows where we are with the authorities.
Yeah, on that point, Johnny, Matt Hughes in the Daily Mail this morning was talking about the FA and other governing bodies. They're facing racial diversity targets in boardrooms from next year. I'd applaud that. Am I confident that it will happen? Probably not. Are we seeing in the sort of through the prism of racism, football's lack of leadership exposed?
Yes, very much so, because it does take leadership as a word. It takes deftness, it takes intelligence, and it takes authority to tackle problems of this sort, and that's lacking. And too often, let's say the governing bodies in England just look like they're desperate to make statements that will go down well with the public, that will play well in terms of the optics, to use that terrible word. But I don't always detect sincerity behind them. And the diversity targets are a big test for the FA, because they have to enact them. And we've already seen them flex the kind of things when it comes to appointing, let's say, the next England coach or the next technical director. Suddenly there's a sort of flexing of the principles that they've laid down, maybe we don't quite have to do what we said we were going to do in terms of, you know, interviewing black candidates or whatever. They come up with reasons. So we'll see. They having made such play from the new diversity targets, they now have to do something with them. But, you know, we're seeing lack of leadership throughout the authorities in England at a lot of levels, and this is a test for them.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to someone who was involved in the meetings before the Millwall match against Queen's Park Rangers. It was interesting that there was some criticism of the way that the FA and also the EFL conducted themselves, and that was balanced by huge praise for the Kick It Out delegation and also from the PFA. On that, Art, you know, you mentioned there Queen's Park Rangers score, a couple of players take a knee, raise a fist. Marlon Romeo, who I thought has been outstanding, showed outstanding moral courage over this weekend. He was applauded off at the end. What is the fallout, do you think, from the events at the Den over the last few days?
It's a strange one to answer. I think in terms of just looking at the situation for what it is, a lot of people kind of understand now what the problem is in a maybe a more real sense, in the fact that, as Johnny mentioned earlier, it's not just calling someone a name that is going to be deemed as racism, but not actually supporting the cause to fight against racism is just as bad in a sense of principle, because if you can't understand that and you frame it as something that is, I've seen people calling it a political movement over the last few days, when if standing against racism is political, then I'm not sure what is. But if there is that lack of understanding. How do you get people to understand? And I think it's not by putting them in a classroom and showing them a bunch of slides. It's by players taking actions like these, because you can talk about, oh, people need more diversity training and stuff like that. If you bring the fourth official example from last night, you could say, oh yeah, we're going to fine him and give him more training, in internal training. And he might, with that training, he might understand he can't say certain words, but it may just be, okay, I won't say that now because if I do, I'll get in trouble. Whereas if you see the actual ramifications of your actions, you're not going to do them, not just because you don't want to get in trouble, but because you may feel the consequences of what those actions are to other people. So for instance, Demba Ba last night putting pressure on the fourth official, he's going to feel the anger of Demba Ba a lot more than he is going to if he was to just read it off a slide in four walls. So I think that's where, not just the Millwall example, I know I may have gone off on a little bit of a tangent when answering this, but the Millwall and PSG games this in the past few days, that's probably where people have, I don't want to say awoke, but where people may be a bit more understanding to what the issue actually is. And it's not a quick fix, by the way.
Mike, may I just ask, you know, you with your knowledge of Millwall, and it's a club I struggle to understand sometimes, but how do you feel about this week and how you know the events have sort of played out and how the club's handled it?
I think the club were hugely relieved at the reaction last night. I just thought, you know, they have been facing an existential crisis. And if I'm completely honest, I spoke to some senior figures over the weekend, and my view was that they should have closed the ground last night. That obviously didn't happen. Balancing that, I can't conceive that you've got 1,300, 1,400, however many people booed on Saturday, racists within one ground. I can't conceive that. I can see that people are maybe reflecting a very confused and a very divided society, and there is a racial element within the Millwall support. What I've found, I thought it was a step forward of sorts last night. And I am really encouraged that the club, I've always actually had a very good relationship with Kick It Out. I think Kick It Out as an organisation requires much more strategic support from the authorities. It doesn't probably get it. And that's, you know, when I look at the money that's being siphoned through, let's say, the PFA, I find it inconceivable that Kick It Out don't get the sort of funding that they need to do the job that they have to do. This is a long-term process, but also you have social issues with which to deal. And frankly, that's generational. What you have to understand about Millwall as a football club, I feel, it's very complex. And there is a pride, now some would say it was a warped pride, but there is a pride in their difference and their ability or their habitual, almost effortless ability to cause some people offence. Now, you know, I, though, go back to the sort of people I spoke to over the weekend who were desperately, desperately depressed. They were devastated by what'd gone on because they saw the damage created to an institution that they feel actually does a lot of social good. So it was a really difficult evening. I think probably they got away with it, but I think there's an awful lot more work to do. And in that, you know, I think also we have to look at the broader picture. This is not just one club. And I think we have to look at the picture of the way that football addresses its responsibilities. I still think it is backward. It's feudal in many ways. And I suppose, speaking of which, and we'll go on to another big picture issue here, it's the 25th anniversary of Jean-Marc Bosman winning freedom of contract. There's a BT Sport documentary being aired on Wednesday night. I think it's going to be repeated at the weekend, which highlights the personal cost. I suppose I better give a quick history lesson before we start. Bosman had played for Liège for 2 years. They offered him a new contract, which represented a 75% pay cut. They put him on the market for €500,000. He was suspended for a season, which was legal at that time in Belgium, because they couldn't agree a deal with Dunkirk. Now, it took 5 years, but the European Court of Justice ruled that he and any other player could move where they wished when out of contract. He was 31 and effectively finished as a footballer. He became depressed and drank. Now, Johnny, you met him at his parents' house, I believe. Impressions of him?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be fascinated to watch this documentary because that trip stuck in my mind for years. It was about 1997, I think it was, 97 or maybe early 98. I was working for Scotland on Sunday at the time. I was a young journalist, and Bosman had already changed football, and I got in touch with him through his lawyer, went over to Belgium, drove to his house in Liège to do an interview with him. And he wasn't quite what I expected then. You know, he wasn't this sort of kind of political figure or freedom fighter at all. He was quite a forlorn character sitting in, you know, I remember this kind of very average apartment in Liège being kind of dark and slightly depressing place, and him sitting there in an armchair in his parents' house and telling me that he felt football had forgotten him. And at that point we were just starting to see the first Bosman transfers, and of course that is what gave player wages a quantum leap, because players were able to you know, claim get signing on fees or transfer fees as wages, and all of a sudden, and he was bitter then about the number of players that were making a lot of money, and football was, you know, him that had fought for them had been forgotten about, and he had been forgotten about. And that was in 1997. I'm not surprised he's had problems, really, because you could tell then he was struggling with it. And even that, you know, back then it felt disgraceful that this guy had been left to do all the players' dirty work, the fighting, and then been sort of ignored, forgotten about by the players' unions, by the players' unions in Belgium, but also FIFPro and so on. It must have been a big burden for him to deal with, and it did end his career. That's the thing. He wasn't a fantastic player, but I think he was an okay. I think he was a fullback maybe, and after the legal wrangle, he never really played again. So he started off as a guy just trying to win the right to move clubs, and he ended up killing off his own career and then spending many years, I think, and we'll see in the documentary, having to watch other players get rich on the back of his sacrifice, I suppose. I felt sorry for him then, and as I say, it'll be interesting to see how the last 20 odd years have unfolded. But you know, he's a forgotten hero, I think, for players.
Yeah, as you said, he enriched thousands of players, probably. Given our disquiet with the way football is run, Johnny, did the establishment set out to punish him?
Maybe unconsciously. I mean, he was a pariah. He was portrayed as a troublemaker, and he was shunned, I guess, in his own country, and by the international players union didn't seem to do much for him. So yes, he was a guy that you know, football, I think, still has, and we were, you know, this speaks to what we were talking about, football still has a kind of conservative of the small c mentality where you don't speak out and you get on with the game and you just get on with things, and you know, and that's what Bosman was, a victim of that, because when you wind it all back, he was simply, you know, an employee who wanted the right to move to another company when the company he worked for didn't want them anymore. And we forget that players did used to be shackled by these contracts where they didn't have that freedom. We take it for granted now, but it wasn't for granted, you know, it wasn't there. He had to win it for people. But he certainly wasn't, where he was different to what I expect, he wasn't a firebrand. He was a very normal guy who didn't set out to create this big change. He just set out on a point of principle for himself, and then the consequences unfolded from there.
Art, you know, as we've mentioned, you're close to an emerging generation of players. Do they know Bosman's story? And if not, should they?
In terms of the story itself, I'm not sure they probably know it off by heart like they would other stories. I think they would know that they are in their right to look for other clubs when their contracts are running down. And I think we've seen that a lot with especially young English talents in recent years, where they run their contracts down, are able to move to foreign clubs for quite small fees and then excel there before coming back here. And they should be allowed to do that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying it's something that happens. Whether they're aware of why they're able to do it, I'm not too sure. And I guess this is a way where they may be able to educate themselves on what is behind these decisions that they're making today, where the footwork was done 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I suppose if you look at it objectively, Johnny, the morality of the transfer market has got worse since he made his stand. You know, the system's probably in need of some sort of overhaul. I don't think it's realistic to talk about a US-style draft system. But I suppose the question is, and it's a question which relates to a lot of what we've been speaking about, is that will football ever change until it's forced to do so?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's funny reflecting on the transfer system where, yeah, it's only really changed in that the power's gone to the players and the agents more in particular, and where it was with the clubs, but there's still not a kind of restraint on how it operates. And there's perhaps no more loyalty or care from one party to the other than there was then. Football is not really set up, though, for international regulation, I guess, you know, to try and bring... I mean, Bosman initially just came in, I think, if I remember right, for European players and then spread out to the rest of the world. But, you know, I would love to see some more kind of stable transfer system. I don't know if it's a draft or whatever, but you know, something that is more transparent, creates a bit spending restraint, maybe has a social mission to it, where there's a certain amount of money it sort of goes off as tax to fund causes and good and change for the good in the game. I don't think it'll ever happen, I'm afraid. And I don't, you know, football won't change unless it's forced. And as we've been speaking earlier, there's not enough leadership to force real changes.
Yeah, well, all too often in modern football, money loses its meaning. Mesut Ozil's paid £350,000 a week not to play a game most would pay for peanuts. Not entirely his fault, you'd say, and it doesn't reflect particularly well on anyone involved. Football excuses the greed of super agents and places a price on the head of a 10-year-old boy. That can't be right. It's wrong also that Jean-Marc Bosman has been punished for his moral courage. Football ruined his career. It airbrushed him out of history. The least he deserved was gratitude and understanding. Watch the film and I'm sure you'll join me in wishing him well. Football's got a lot to sort out. Thanks, though, to Johnny and Art for their insight and to you for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.